Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and legal procedures and breaks them down into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're going to look at pretrial release in criminal cases, what different types exist, and what a judge may consider in setting those conditions. We'll jump into the world of bond and bail and explain why some criminal defendants are kept behind bars and some are released. Judge Gail, this is something that I know my years on the bench and yours has always been a thorny issue. And
absolutely,
that is, we are asked as judges to determine whether or not we're going to release someone who has been arrested and incarcerated, whether we are to release them prior to trial, and if so, under what conditions.
And if I can interject, sometimes you're asked to revisit that order during trial.
Yeah.
And certainly after.
It's an ongoing situation.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Not a one-time thing, but usually when a person is arrested and they're incarcerated, the first time they appear before a judge, or sometimes a magistrate, but in our cases, they appear before us as judges, we had to make that initial determination, sometimes with very little information, hardcore information. And you know, if you release the wrong person and they go out and commit another crime, or they cause harm to themselves or somebody else, I always, sort of felt that was on me, you know, because I made a bad decision about the person's release.
Well, I could tell you one thing. If you don't feel like it's on you, the next person or people you're going to see is the media, who's more likely than not, certainly going to color the situation such that it is on you.
And these decisions are complex, and I want to get into the complexity of them, because let's go back to the basics of criminal law in the United States. A person is presumed innocent even though they're arrested and incarcerated. They're presumed innocent unless or until they're proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt to a judge or a jury, a unanimous jury of their peers. So a pretrial incarceration cannot be a pretrial punishment. And that's where it gets sticky. You know, you can't punish a person because you think they're heinous or they've done a heinous thing. You can't punish them inordinately by keeping them incarcerated. You have to look at ways to perhaps release them. But at the same time, you don't want to release people that are going to go out and wreak havoc. You know, don't you find this a perplexing situation?
I generally do. But I guess it depends on the case. It depends on the parties. Would you agree that it often depends on, like, that limited information you said you often don't have, and the expectation that judges have to make decisions without the benefit of being able to see the future?
Right. Would you agree, though, that in all the times, and I've done thousands of bonds, I know you have as well, or thousands of pretrial releases, you know, that you're always thinking about maybe categories. I did anyway, you know, people who had property offenses, I was more likely to let out than people who had violent offenses charged against them. Those were always the questionable ones with me. Drug offenses, I usually would let out. You know, you sort of had categories where things fell. Did you operate that way?
I know that I could certainly put things in certain categories, but I don't know that it was always a determining factor. I don't know that the category was always a determining factor.
No, but it was a consideration.
Absolutely. For example, yes, it does matter whether the crime was a violent crime or not. And even if a crime was not a violent crime, so say, for example, I had a child who's been accused of financially fleecing a parent that has limited mobility and is, you know, reliant on help, et cetera. It may be that the offense or the crime is not violent, but I am concerned if the defendant has either nowhere else to go or the defendant will continue to have access to the victim, because although the crime is not violent, the propensity or the likelihood that the defendant might be accused again. I'm not suggesting that they were guilty of the offense itself, but the idea that they could be accused of additional or similar offenses certainly was something that kind of hovered over the situation. And I don't want to be responsible for creating an environment that potentially allows the victim to be victimized again by allegedly the same person or someone else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think that that is a perfect example of how you as a judge and I as a judge think through the process. You know, you're looking at all of these variables.
What, correct.
The what ifs. Mm-hmm. You know, what if this person's going to continue fleecing this old person? What if they're going to take advantage? What if the older relative is going to be in physical danger? You know, mm-hmm. What if? It's a whole series of what ifs that you're running through your head in lightning speed because, you know, you've got a few minutes to make this decision. You know, less than 5 minutes, sometimes a minute or two.
And without sufficient response to all of those questions that you have kind of rippling through your head, you're thinking, okay, I have to make a decision that's in the best interest of everyone that's here. And
how can I do no harm? How can I do no harm?
Right. And I'm also thinking, and I suspect you did too, I'm thinking, okay, what is the least restrictive option that I have? Something that will kind of achieve these goals, but it's not so restrictive that the defendant kind of presupposes that I've already made some decision here, or that the court still has the benefit of objectivity, and that the parties understand that the court is still open, objective, and has not leaned to one side or another, because that is so important in the litigation process, is that neither side be made to believe that the fix is in.
Yeah,
and that the
right.
judge has already right. made a decision merely based on a bond decision at the very beginning. But I'll throw this out there to you. Have you ever had a situation where you believed or you see that setting a bond that actually might incarcerate someone or keep them detained is more so in their best interest than anyone else's?
Yes. I've kept somebody, if I thought that they were going to do harm to themselves or somebody might do harm to them,
yes,
and they were safer to be incarcerated,
mm-hmm.
I have set bond or pretrial release conditions accordingly,
mm-hmm.
and with the effort of keeping them in, with the caveat, once you get a lawyer or you work with your lawyer can come back to me at a later time when things settle out and I'll review your bond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I this isn't for now and forever. You know, this is for now. You know, and that I think protected everyone, but kept the door open for further review.
Indeed. Indeed. And I certainly agree with that. And those are not always the easiest decisions, but they are necessary in some rare instances where you genuinely believe that the best interests of the defendant, as well as the victims or the alleged victims, where in some instances we had defense attorneys would refer to them as complaining witnesses, that it was in their best interest for them to remain incarcerated because the threat may be way too high.
Have you ever done this? I've said that your precondition for release would be that you are admitted to a rehab program.
Oh, yes.
And you know, you're going to stay in jail until you're admitted to the program, and then you'll be released to that program.
So we called it finding a bed. So yeah, okay. we may detain you until we can find a bed, meaning a treatment bed,
right,
for the defendant, because I'm not certain how many times you've had this experience, but I've certainly lost defendants.
Oh, yeah.
Who were released. And because they were released and they were not detained, and I understand also that law enforcement is rarely trained to deal with individuals who are detoxing. And so jails are not designed to be places where someone can safely detox, because the staff there are not trained to deal with that high level of drug engagement and interaction. But in many instances, they are safer there than they are being returned to the community in whatever environment they were in, because I've had experiences where I've never seen them again. And I didn't see them again because they died.
Yeah, I've had unfortunate situations where you release someone that you suspected had a drug habit. Mm-hmm. There perhaps were no beds available, or the person masks their drug habit effectively, and you release them, and then they overdose and die. That it's not your fault as the judge, but you take notice of it, and you feel some responsibility.
Oh yeah, I think it's almost impossible to not feel some responsibility for what happens, because you always wonder if you had done something different, if the result would have changed.
If I could have been more creative, if mm-hmm. I had asked one more question, you know, mm-hmm. you go the what ifs again.
Or if I had just listened to that one piece of information, or I don't know how I missed that, or
yes,
how I did not know that was lurking. And let's be honest, just as our law enforcement are not trained in necessarily dealing with individuals who are in active detox from a drug addiction, judges are rarely trained with how to spot or identify some of these same maladies that lead to death of some defendants. Now, there are those who just kind of had that, what I call that third eye open, and yes, they're relying or leaning into their intuition, or maybe their experiences. Like if you were a defense attorney and you had enough clients who had enough of those experiences, so you knew it when you saw it, then that may be helpful in those instances. But not everyone comes with that background or that experience or even that insight or ability. And therefore, it's really difficult to not feel a level of responsibility when the unthinkable happens.
In most states, judges are given guidelines either by statute or by rule of what they can and cannot consider in determining pretrial release. Some of those things are things like past record of the individual, a record of non-appearance if they've been ordered to come to court in the past and haven't appeared. Are they a flight risk? Or are they going to take off and leave the jurisdiction? Are they a danger to others? Do they have a history of violence? You know, those are not, that's not a complete list, but those are things that I always considered when I was looking at bond. Did I miss any?
I think those are pretty much the the most common ones. I think if there's anything else, there are things that are kind of unique to the situation itself. For example, when I was a prosecutor, even if, you know, there was, you know, potentially the model defendant, which I don't know what is a model defendant, but there's a model defendant who perhaps presented with none of the issues or concerns. However, the nature of the offense still, you know, left me with some uneasiness because of the uniqueness of it. I would call that to the court's attention. For example, you know, the defendant may not have a prior criminal record at all, maybe, you know, willing to surrender their passport so that they are not a flight risk or do not present as a flight risk, may have an entire gallery of family members that they are there to demonstrate the level of support that they have, and may have had, you know, long-term employment, which we often use to determine their, quote, ties to the community, whether or not they would actually, you know, be, they'll actually return because right. they have a vested interest in the community. And so if I had a model defendant where kind of all the boxes are checked, but, you know, perhaps I had a situation where I feel like there are particularized and very articulable threats to a victim or a party or a witness, notwithstanding this, you know, model's, you know, behavior, it may be important to bring, especially if there may be threats of violence or some kind of financial harm or ruin or something, I'm going to, as a prosecutor, I would be sure to raise that and bring that to the court's attention, because those may be the reasons why the preference or the request is to keep the defendant incarcerated, not just to issue a protection order or a restraining order or no contact order, but to literally incarcerate the defendant so as to ensure that the witnesses and the victims remain safe throughout the pendency of the case, because you may lose them if the defendant is released.
Let's have an example here. Somebody has a white collar job, is from all appearances in the community very responsible, but is before the court for domestic violence against a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And as judge, you learn that although this is the first charge of domestic violence, the police had been called to the house on 5 previous occasions. Now, you've got a person who's got respectable job, good employment history, but you've got this propensity for, a charge of violence and a propensity perhaps for future violence, given the past being prologue. What do you do with that kind of thing?
Well, I would say I would first be concerned about the 5 prior calls to law enforcement, and not concerned to the extent that I would be angry or upset, because here's what we know, or we should know about domestic violence, is it takes about that many times for a victim to kind of build up the
courage to file a charge, mm-hmm,
to actually go through with it. But here's what I also know. I also know that domestic violence calls are some of the most dangerous calls police officers will ever respond to. And to have put them in that situation at least 5 times prior tells me that although there may have been no formal charges filed, as my Southern mama would say, everybody ain't lying on you. So something happened. Now, what the something is, I don't know. Who the first aggressor was, I don't know. But I would know that I have a domestic violence charge in front of me. I would know that there was at least an attempt to engage law enforcement at least almost a half dozen times prior. And I do know that although the defendant may be a pillar in the community, maybe they're, you know, on the board of every, you know,
nonprofit
in the whole county, that, you know, they are, you know, the face of the upstanding citizen. And yet, you know, they're here for this. I would absolutely be very, very concerned. I would look to those five times, those five previous times. And although, again, they cannot be used to determine guilt or even acquittal, I would want to know who was involved. Is it the same victim that's here today? Are there other members that were in the house? You know, who is it? Because here's what we know about domestic violence. It's often about control. And if I see someone who's a pillar in a community, everybody thinks they're great, they're wonderful. Here's what I know. They're probably not going to their job and socking their boss in the mouth when they find that they didn't get the raise they wanted. But right. They may go home and take that out on someone because they can demonstrate or exercise that control in that environment, but can't do it at work. So
well, it's control both ways, mm-hmm. Judge Gale. It's controlling of the environment at home. But those five previous calls tell me that there is a loss of control on the part of the defendant.
Absolutely. Now,
whether the person was guilty, obviously there were no charges on those five previous calls, but there was some loss of control that prompted those mm-hmm. five. So it's that loss of control that really bothers me.
And what I tell people all the time is, listen, of all the things police officers are, creative writers, they are not. They are not.
Absolutely. You know, you're absolutely right.
Rolling up and down.
My police friends would agree 100%.
They're just not. They, you know, they just write what you give them. And, you know, if you're suggesting, oh, they got it all wrong, or this was wrong, or they're just lying. I'm not suggesting that police officers do not embellish, because we absolutely know that that is the case. What I am telling you is that they are not by trade creative writers. So that's just not really their strong suit, nor are they really generally just, you know, tooling up and down your street and deciding randomly to knock on your door five times because you just have a nice paint color and they figured they'd just come and check it out. That's just not what's happening in those instances either. They are being summoned to a location for a reason. And generally that reason is something that they are, again, cataloging in their report, which is, I don't know about you, but I rarely read a police report that reads like a nice novel. I mean, there are times when I'm like scratching my head to try to understand the completeness of the sentence.
Use of pronouns. He took that to her and they placed it over there.
There, yes, with this. And I'm like, wait, what?
With this.
What happened? Yeah. And so oftentimes it really is just a matter of trying to piece everything together so that it makes sense. And of course, you will have the rebuttal, but you're absolutely right, Judge, that I would take all of these things into consideration. And you know, of course, and I think you might agree, above all, I'm thinking, what is the threat level to the community and who's representing the community? Is it the victim? Is it, you know, someone else? And is there no less restrictive way that I can craft an order to impose something that will still keep everyone safe and ensure that when we get back here, you know, when we come back, there's not going to be another case with another set of charges for, you know, a same or similar person, is what I'm really truly trying to avoid.
Okay. You talk about least restrictive conditions. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned that a couple of times, and I would agree with you. That's really the mandate for judges, to have the least restrictive, because again, it's not a pretrial punishment. The person is presumed to be not guilty. Let's use our hypothetical here. The least restrictive kind of pretrial release is what's called release on your own recognizance, which is a mouthful, and it just means you're released on your promise to return to each and every aspect of the court proceeding. You're making a promise to return. That's the least restrictive. Would you agree?
I would. And I'm also going to note your excellent use of Latin with recognizance.
You're usually the Latin scholar, not me. But, you know, it's you're just saying, okay, We're not going to make you post any money. You're not going to do anything, but you're going to have to sign a written promise that you're going to come. And if you don't, we're going to issue a warrant for your arrest.
Yes.
You know, and then we'll consider that in setting your next bond or your next pretrial release conditions, and they're going to be more onerous. But
indeed, it is like, we're going to take you at your word. You understand that you have to respond to these charges, and we don't need you to do or to put up anything extra other than your signature here that says you can take my word that I am going to return for the court proceedings. And the court has already weighed a lot of other things that go into that, you know, the nature of the offense, again, their connection to the community, they're likely to flee the jurisdiction, you know, their return, maybe sometimes whether or not they've secured counsel or if they intend to secure counsel, because that becomes another way to kind of keep tabs on the defendant while the matter's pending. So if you know, if the court is really being insightful, they're kind of going through again in like that half a minute or so.
Right.
But they're considering all of these factors and making a determination without being able to predict the future.
Let's take our hypothetical of our guy charged with domestic violence, our white collar employee. He owns a home. His name's on the deed. He's got a good job making good money. He's probably not a flight risk, and he's not going to take off. He has no prior criminal record, even though we've had these five calls. He's probably going to have a lawyer, so he's going to appear. He's not going to probably try to do this on his own. He might be a danger to others, and we've got this sketchy history. So what do we do with him? Do we release him on his own recognizance, a promise to return? And if we do, do we add any conditions to that that might answer some of these other questions, whether he's a danger to others or a history of violence?
I actually think that it may be a safe bet to release the defendant even on his own recognizance with some very strict pretrial conditions.
Okay, now let's talk about those, because you can add those. Mm-hmm. That's all part of the pretrial release. It's mm-hmm. not just posting money. It's sometimes meeting certain conditions.
Absolutely. So I would certainly make a determination as to who all of the affected parties are in the case and understand that at this juncture, you know, if it's domestic violence, you may have one active victim, meaning the person that is alleged to have been hurt or threatened by the defendant. And so that may be true. However, I think sometimes we forget the impact of these experiences on bystanders, particularly children.
Children, yeah.
And so I may, in fact, for purposes of a brief pretrial period, I may impose an order of either protection for the benefit of the actual victim, and maybe no or very limited contact with any bystanders that would have been negatively impacted, like the children, especially if they, you know, were there and they are potential witnesses. If they were traumatized by the experience, and I realize parents may want to continue to have contact with their children, especially while they're going through a circumstance like this, but it may not be in the child's best interest. And sometimes those engagements can be used to manipulate a child's recollection or their memory. And I want to try to whatever degree I can either, you know, preserve it or thwart any manipulation. So if there is contact, it may be supervised, but it may not take place immediately, like immediately following or at that particular hearing. I may severely limit it. Additionally, you know what? I might require the defendant to check in with my probation department fairly regularly, maybe weekly. If I think that at the heart of this may have been drugs or alcohol, I might require, you know, frequent testing with an order to not engage in any drugs or in any illegal drugs or non-prescription drugs and certainly no alcohol. I may put in all kinds of things that I think are designed to be kind of guardrails, if you will.
Yeah, I was thinking a release on his own recognizance with an order that he, while the case is pending, that he not live in the marital residence, that he either seek another place to live or live with a relative or whatever.
But I should have said that. Thank you. That would have been sort of
extricate him from the marital residence, have no contact with the alleged victim here.
And not to the guest house in the back. You have right. to like literally leave.
Right. No contact with the alleged victim, in this case, his wife. And as far as the children go, I like your idea of maybe a delay, but then any contact would be until further order of the court, supervised contact, either meeting the children at children's services or another place that could be agreed upon, but basically monitored contact. The kids aren't going to come to dad's place and stay overnight or spend a weekend. That's not what we're talking about here.
I would absolutely agree. And can I just note as an aside, part of the reason why I think both you and I go through the kind of mental machinations that we've just described in order to fashion something very specific for this case, because remember, this isn't, you know, something that you just, that is boilerplate, or you just kind of cut and paste into every single case that may present even with same or similar charges, because everybody's different. But we also, I think, appreciate that there is an impact to every decision the court makes. Even though the defendant in this case is a white collar, you know, seemingly, you know, maybe middle class, you know, pretty right. solid family and community and has all these things lined up. So often what I would see in my court were not the middle class defendants. It would be someone who's really, really struggling, especially financially. And so there's oftentimes no benefit to imposing a bond that's anything other than their own recognizance, because it might as well be $1 million because they don't have anything to pay, and nor do they have anyone right. in their life to pay it. And so you might as well just tell them they're going to be staying in jail. But what we also know, I think you can appreciate this as well, is what we also know is that this studies have shown us, and statistics show, that it only takes 72 hours, 3 days, for literally for the bottom to fall out for someone on average who is incarcerated for a, you know, a lower level offense, or even if, you know, something that especially is nonviolent. And by that, I mean, if you're dealing with individuals who are on the lower rung of the socioeconomic spectrum, it takes about 72 hours for them to lose employment. About that long for them to have their housing at risk. If they have children, it takes about that long for Children Family Services to become engaged and the potential for them to experience loss of access.
Let's give the example of a single mom.
Yeah.
Employed single mom mm-hmm. Who happens to shoplift $250 worth of stuff from Walmart.
Yep.
You know, what do you do with her? You know,
yeah. And so I think there is a time when the knee jerk reaction would be, you know, hey, you know, bond is, you know, $5,000, 10% cash, or it's $500 or surety. So find a bondsman. And I always say, well, if you think about it, if she's arrested for shoplifting, then that's probably a telltale sign that she has limited financial resources. So $5,000 might as well be $5 million, because if she didn't have $250 for groceries, she surely doesn't have $500
I had a guy tell me that one time in court. I thought I was giving him a break, and I said, sir, I'm only going to set your bond at $100. And he said, $100? Hell, might as well be $1 million.
Because I got no dollars. So, that's right. You're not helping me when you don't really understand the landscape here.
That was a wake-up call for me, I'll tell you.
And you probably were like, well, wait a minute. I thought I was doing something good. I only said $100.
Exactly.
And so understanding why somebody's feet are in the room is so very important, because I would be thinking, again, if this person, and I might also consider the fact that, okay, if this is the single mom that's been here, you know, four times this month, and you know, their prior record looks like the Old Testament, then maybe we need to be thinking of this a little bit differently. I realize you may not have had money, but you also cannot terrorize and victimize a whole community because of that. We need to figure out something else. But barring that, and so let's suggest that maybe she does not have a prior history or a prior record, and this is the first offense, I would absolutely be disinclined to impose a bond that would be, you know, so much more onerous than the offense itself. Again, $250 worth of groceries versus a, you know, $5,000 bond at 10% is still $500. She doesn't have it either way. She can't pay either way. And that's evidenced by the fact that she's stealing food. She's not even stealing electronics or something else. This is sustenance. So that tells me there's a deeper problem there. But if I were to incarcerate her, then remember, she may lose her job if she's an hourly wage earner
and she doesn't show up. I mean, let's say she works at Wendy's or McDonald's.
Yeah, I was
going to
say
if she's
a waitress or she works, you know, at a fast food restaurant. Trust me, and the turnover there is high anyway. She's more likely than not going to lose the employment that she has. When the neighbors find out, because she's got to call and get somebody to go pick the babies up, once they realize she hasn't been around for 3 days, then the next call they're making is to Children's Family Services.
So her children
are now in foster care because she's been incarcerated. And my goodness, don't let this be around the time when the rent is due. Because even if it's not around the time that the rent is due, if children are left abandoned in a property that's being rented, guess what? It's going to send signals to the landlord. And the landlord is not going to permit someone to remain there without regard to the reason. They're going to be seeking to evict her almost instantly because they don't want the trouble of law enforcement either. So she may face loss of housing, loss of employment, loss of her children. Who knows if she has a stabilized support system or any support system at all? And again, all of this can happen inside of 72 hours.
Yeah, and it happens quickly. So those are all considerations that we as judges put into place and think through as we make our decisions. So let's get to a point where we don't release somebody on their own recognizance or their promise to return. Let's look at the types of bail or bond. Now, those are two terms that I think are synonymous. It's like lawyer and attorney. They both mean the same thing, but there are different kinds of bond. There's a cash bond where I say, to get out of jail, you're going to have to post $1,000. That means you or a relative, you're going to have to come in, give the clerk of courts $1,000. If you report each and every aspect of your case, you'll get the bulk of that money back. If you don't, you're going to forfeit that money to the court. So that's a form of cash bond. Would you say that's a good definition?
That is an excellent definition. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, some people historically didn't have $1,000 to come post to the court, or their relatives didn't have $1,000 to come post to the court. So the person would go to a bondsman. And that would be a company that would post the money for the individual at a surcharge of about 10% or more. These bonding companies were shady, shady kinds of businesses. But what would happen is if the person would skip out, the bonding companies would then go after them. You know, you've seen vigilantes. Well, that's part of this whole concept. most states thought, you know, these bonding companies are not all that reputable. How can we do the same thing without involving a bonding company? And so some states came up with a 10% rule, for example. So with our hypothetical, I would tell the person, hey, I'm making your bond $1,000, but I know you don't have $1,000, so I'm going to allow you to get out of jail if you bring to the clerk's office 10% of that amount. So for $100, I'm going to let you out. Now, if you don't show up at the court hearings and I have to issue a warrant for your arrest, not only are you going to lose that $100, but you're going to owe me $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
With the idea of sort of limiting the effectiveness of these quote unquote shady bonding companies. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I think that even with, you know, the 10%, there's still those who struggle to get to that. But yes.
Mm-hmm. And I try to take that into consideration. If I know I'm going to give a 10% bond, I'm trying to go, how can this person make it? So do I make it a $500 bond at 10%? Mm-hmm. Do I make it a $100 bond at 10%? You know, what do I do? Sometimes it's more symbolic than actually anything else.
You're absolutely right. And I think also, and I'll tell you, this is from just my own experience. In, you know, 2025, we see that there are a lot of ways to satisfy bond. Remember, you know, you were saying, hey, if you bring me $100 on this $1,000 bond, I'll let you out. But there have to be practical ways to even access that. For a lot of people, you know, they don't have it, but they need to be able to contact family, friends, or support systems in order to assist them. What I did when I was on the bench is I installed a credit card machine, because there were some people who didn't have the liquid cash, but if they had a credit card, they were willing to do that, you know, or other ways for them, you know, to satisfy it, including, you know, money orders, or, you know, making sure they knew where, like, the nearest ATM machines were. If they were someone supporting someone who was eligible for being bonded out, but just couldn't get access to the money. This was so important. I think the credit card machine probably made one of the biggest differences for so many people, because again, liquid cash is sometimes very difficult to do, but being able to use whatever limited amount of credit you have to bond someone out may be the difference between, you know, them retaining custody of their children. Or not.
I've actually seen some courts in my travels, I don't know whether you've had, that have had ATM machines in their lobbies.
I've seen, well, there was an ATM, I want to say, I believe there was an ATM machine in the lobby. But I juxtapose that against, and we'll get to, I think, if not this episode, another one, a discussion on fines, where I've seen individuals being held and required to what I call dial for dollars and satisfy fines in order to be released, which I think is despicable.
Yeah, I've never done that. I don't think that's right.
And for as much as I think that's bad on the part of the court, I would also say I think it's even worse on the part of local governments who rely on courts to be banks and to make money, because that is because I think there are local governments who understand that is the power and authority of the court, but it should never be wielded that way, and it should never be utilized that way. But
shouldn't be considered by the court either.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
At any level,
I think the court should be strong enough to push back and to say, you know what, we are a court, not a bank. This is not how we do business. And I will say it even here, you know, publicly on this podcast. I was in a community where, you know, the local government was amazingly ignorant to the role of the court and genuinely believed that the court was nothing more than a bank and that it served the purpose of it. Essentially, you know, any budget that the court was given, it was supposed to spend the balance of the year kind of raising that money back through fines to essentially reimburse the community for whatever budget the community had given the court or the city had given the court. And that's absolutely what courts are not for.
Yeah,
judges should never be there saying, hey, look, you know what? We got to cover the probation salary this month. So I have to impose this fine.
Yeah.
And you can't go pick your kid up from the bus station until you call enough people to pay this so that you can leave and we'll all be happy. I think that's absolutely despicable, but it's also why people lose faith in the court system.
I agree. I want to talk about, you know, variations of bonds. And one of the ones, maybe you can give a quick and dirty definition of property bonds. You know, they used to be more popular than they are now, but they're still popular.
They are. And it's so sad. It's so sad. And I say it's sad because there are many of folks who've lost their property as a result of, you know, bond forfeitures.
And we're talking about real estate. We're talking about
real estate.
Real property.
So think of this example, you know, grandson, you know, finds himself hanging out with the wrong group of friends. They get arrested for, let's say, you know, involuntary manslaughter. And at arraignment, the court says, hey, you know, this is a pretty serious case. There's been loss of life. And, you know, you may not have been directly responsible, but indirectly, you are still held responsible. So I'm going to set the bond at, you know, $50,000. And you have to use, and you can do cash, surety, or property. You don't have the cash. You don't have a bondsman. But grandma has a house, and grandma doesn't want to see you in jail. And the court says, understand that, you know, if you don't come back and you don't appear for every hearing and you don't comply with all of the pretrial conditions, you know, you could forfeit the bond. You can lose the bond.
Grandma's
money.
House is going to be sold.
Exactly. And so grandma says, I trust my grandson. He's always done what I've told him to do. I don't believe he did anything wrong here. He's been living right and he played the drums at church. So he's going to come back. And lo and behold, maybe he attends the first couple court hearings, but by the time trial rolls around, he's nowhere to be found. He has left. And remember, grandma has now decided to promise or pledge to the court, I'm going to have him here. And I have so much faith in him coming. I'm willing to put my house on the line. I will put up my house. And the very place that I lived in and maybe even raised him in, I'm going to put that on the line because I know he's going to show up. And trial shows up and everybody's waiting and folks are tapping their fingers and grandson never shows up and he doesn't appear. And the court forfeits the bond, meaning, hey, we call in the promise. Grandma, you can't get him here. And
that house now belongs to the state.
Now that house belongs to the government. And so this is unfortunate because it's happened so many times when frequently it's the elderly or these are, you know, usually family members who are not cash rich. So they can't access liquid cash, nor can they utilize the services of a bondsman, but they may have a piece of property they're willing to use to ensure that a loved one returns to court. And now we have a few more tools like GPS monitoring and the like, because you have so many people who will in fact do that. They will pledge their homes to ensure that someone will return to court, only for that to not happen. And like you said, Judge, now their house is the property of the government because it's been forfeited.
Another aspect of bond, and you mentioned this earlier in our discussion, Judge, but I think it bears more weight, and that is depositing of passports. If you're in middle America, that's maybe not as big an issue as you are in some of the border states, but that can be huge.
Oh, absolutely. Especially if you have a defendant that has a lot of resources, not just personally, but they're surrounded by resources. So let's say, for example, you have a defendant female who is, you know, who's drug addicted, but also alleged to be engaged in drug trafficking. And maybe their family has supposedly cut them off. But lo and behold, you show up at arraignment and, you know, there's so many diamonds and pearls shining in the back of the courtroom, you're almost blind because the whole family's there. And you know that maybe the defendant may not have, you know, perhaps direct access to these resources, but they still have a passport. And so if the family wants them to jet off someplace and to potentially not face the worst of the consequences, it may not be, again, the defendant that you're so worried about, but maybe their access to resources that you do worry about, and you require that they surrender their passport. And in addition to surrendering their passport, Judge, I don't know if you've ever done this, but I might also require that they seek travel approval from the court anytime they intend to travel outside the court's jurisdiction. So I yes. want to know every time you're planning to leave. I don't care if you go into the family reunion in Kalamazoo. It does not matter to me.
Or if you have a doctor's appointment mm-hmm. in a major city.
Yep.
You know, I need some proof that's happening.
I need proof that it's happening. I want to see the actual appointment itself. I want to see what the travel plans are, what the, you know, what airline you're traveling on, the dates that you're traveling, where you're going to be staying, when you're returning. I may want all of that information before I permit you to travel. Otherwise, you're going to have to cancel that appointment because you won't be going. And if you do go and the court doesn't know about it, I'm going to issue a warrant. So I promise your next appointment is going to be with the, you know, the prison physician.
All right, I want to posit something with you that is my view of pretrial release conditions, and I want to get your response. I think that pretrial release conditions have the greatest impact on the very poor and on the super rich.
Really? That's interesting. Tell me more.
This is one of these things where the middle class comes out on top.
Huh.
Now, I think the impact on the poor is obvious. We've been talking about that. People don't have enough money to post a bond, or they don't have property, or all of that.
That $100 bond you impose.
That $100 bond, you know, is, as the guy said, might as well be a million. You know, that's the thing. It has a huge impact on the poor. The rich often are incarcerated with or released on extreme bond conditions because they are so super mobile. Now, look at it. The Epstein case, Jeffrey Epstein. Harvey Weinstein.
Mm-hmm.
Diddy. Mm-hmm. Sean Diddy Combs.
Yep.
You know, all of those people have been incarcerated. Why? Because in much of no small part, I should say, the fact that they are very mobile, whether they have whether they have passports or not, they have the means and the leverage and the availability of ways to leave the country.
You are correct.
So it's the super rich have just the same kind of restrictions as the super poor. They're just a little different. You know what I mean? But they're still restricted. It's that middle class average Joe, average Sally Smith that you don't care much about, you know?
Mm-hmm. I actually agree that you're absolutely right that it's one of the few times where, you know, being in the middle is actually not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing.
Because you may be able to get out. And you'll have your life will be interrupted. And yes, you'll have some things still hanging over your head, but the immediate effect and impact is not likely to be as daunting or detrimental or overwhelming as it often is for as you said, those who are just socioeconomically depressed and they have nothing, or those who are the super rich. I'll posit this to you. You know, let's say you have had a Jeff Bezos of the world who gets, you know, charged with, you know, involuntary manslaughter. How do you fashion bond conditions for someone like that?
You know, that's what I mean. You restrict the passport. You might have a GPS. You might have a house arrest as opposed to incarceration. I mean, there are all kinds of things but they would be more limiting to that person than John Smith, who's charged with manslaughter.
Can you imagine house arrest for him versus house arrest for someone else? He's like, okay, thanks for, you know, the pass to the palace. I never have to. Which house?
Yeah.
House arrest in which house? Because
hey, let's give house arrest to the mom who stole the $2.50 worth of groceries from Walmart, right?
Right.
She's going, oh, please, no. Let me be in jail. Okay, so I want to move on. We got about 5 minutes, a little less than 5 minutes. I want to talk about, we've talked about pre-trial release. Now, we've seen circumstances, especially lately, and let's mention the Sean Combs case that we've covered here. The jury came back in his trial. He was charged with five things. The jury found him not guilty of three of the most serious, a racketeering charge and two charges of human trafficking, and found him guilty of two charges of taking prostitutes across state lines. The judge had a choice, a hearing. The defense asked that because he was found not guilty of the three more serious charges and only guilty of these two other charges, that he be released on bond pending sentencing. In other words, before sentencing. He's been incarcerated since September, but let's release him prior to sentencing. And the judge said, no, we're not going to do that. This is sort of the other end of pretrial conditions. This is post-trial release. Talk about that for a while.
Well, I think the judge here, I'll try to get a little, I can't reach into the mind of the judge, but I can only imagine that in denying the request for release at this juncture is because the court has decided or acknowledges that it can take a plethora of things into consideration in determining whether or not it should revisit any prior bond decision, not simply or only or, you know, exclusively the verdict from the jury. And I think that's what happened here is essentially the court said, notwithstanding the jury's verdict, I have additional information at my disposal that for the limited purpose of bond, I can still consider and I can determine whether or not that should be used to, you know, to maintain the decision that I first, you know, handed down, which was that the defendant would be held, or if I should change that. And essentially the court just said, you know what? I don't know that there's anything about the verdict from the jury that changes my prior decision, which is still within the purview of the court to do. It can absolutely do that.
And that prior decision was based on potential violence by Diddy or his associates against witnesses or people who would testify against him, and also the fact that he was so rich he could be a major flight risk. Those were the two primary reasons.
Witness intimidation and the concern of a flight risk. Yep.
Right. And those, what you're saying is those remained after the trial as well as they did before the trial.
It was unchanged, apparently, by the judge, at least in the rationale provided. The judge did not seem to be moved by the jury's verdict and changing his decision on, again, the very limited issue of bond. Now, of course, you know, when it comes to sentencing, the court is limited to the charges that the defendant was convicted on in fashioning a sentence. But even then, there are some elements and information that the court can use and rely upon in determining and fashioning what it believes to be an appropriate sentence, which is going to be interesting how that works out.
It's all going to be interesting. But our point is that bond is not just prior to trial. It can be after trial. It's from the beginning of the case mm-hmm. until the case is absolutely over. And in a criminal case, the absolute end of the case is not when the jury verdict comes back, but when the judge actually sentences a guilty defendant.
Indeed.
Judge, how people find us. This was fun. I enjoyed talking about bond and all of our hypotheticals along the way.
You have the best hypotheticals. I appreciate it. It doesn't feel like law school or the LSAT, but it is a fun exercise to remind us of what we need to take into consideration when making these decisions.
The whole idea is for people to follow along and see how we think. And I think we're fairly typical of how other judges think, and to allow them into our thought process, I hope exposes the law and its procedures in a good light.
Indeed. And so if you're ever interested in knowing how we think about other things, and we do think a lot, and we let you into our brains how we navigate these things, we invite you to check out Next Witness, Please, anywhere you find your favorite podcast. We want to thank our primary sponsor, NPR, National Public Radio, for all of the work that it does to keep all of us enlightened and educated. And so you can find us on NPR. But if you are checking us out elsewhere, then just find us anywhere you find your favorite podcasts, such as Apple, Spotify, Amazon. We'll be there waiting for you with Next Witness, Please.
And if you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can shoot me an email. My email address is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, all lowercase, @ohio.edu. And if you also have topics you would like for us to cover, shoot those to me as well, and we'll add them to our list of future episodes. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and legal procedures. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.